So now it's my great pleasure to introduce Chris Bowler, who works at IBANS, Ecole Normale, not far from here, but who was also and has always been very deeply involved in Tara Oceans, and he will tell us about the Tara Oceans project and ecosystems at the planetary scale.
Great. Thank you, Edith. Thank you, Hugues, for the invitation to present the Tara Oceans project today in the François Jacob Day. I thought I would begin with a quote from François, which is sort of the going to be the fil conducteur, if you like, of my presentation. So he's quite famous for this quote. Contrary to what I once thought, scientific progress did not consist simply in observing, in accurately formulating experimental facts and drawing up a theory from them. It began with the invention of a possible world, or a fragment thereof, which was then compared by experimentation with the real world. And it was this constant dialogue between imagination and experiment that allowed one to form an increasingly fine-grained conception of what is called reality. So I think that's a nice quote to begin this this presentation with. So, which will concern the Tara Oceans project, which is now more than 10 years old, actually. Tara Oceans was inspired and directed by Eric Carcenti, who needs no introduction here, I'm sure. Unusual project in that it was centered around the utilization of a sailboat, a research sailboat, as you see here, which performed an expedition around the world under the direction of Eric. So the idea during this this very wet part of the Tara Oceans project was centered on a four-year expedition to explore marine planktonic ecosystems and understand something of their sensitivity to climate change. In addition to the scientific aspects, there was a lot of work done around the popularization of science for the general public, around education, science education, directed towards children in particular, and also efforts to influence policy all the way up to the COP 21 in Paris. So I don't have time to talk about any of these things today, but I'll be happy to talk about them to anybody who's interested. So I'll just focus on the scientific part of the Tara Oceans program, which is centered on the plankton, planktonic organisms, which we can consider as the invisible multitude. Even though you don't see them in the ocean, these organisms are actually incredibly abundant. And in terms of biomass, they represent something like 65%, at least 65% of the biomass in the ocean. The other 35% is what you see on TV, sharks, dolphins, fish, and so on. So these are a very important component of the ecosystem in the ocean. Microscopic, drifting autonomously with the currents. You can see mandala of different kinds of planktonic organisms in this slide, from the larger zooplankton, including metazoans, through to unicellular eukaryotes that we call protists, through to bacteria and also including viruses. These organisms are important in terms of biomass and also in terms of ecosystem function in the ocean. They are the basis of pretty much all oceanic food webs. So if there's no plankton, there's no fish, because fish have nothing to eat. From a biogeochemical point of view, the photosynthetic plankton take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. They generate organic material, biomass, which then feeds into the food webs and goes up. And also through photosynthesis, these organisms generate oxygen, which we all need to breathe, of course. And we know through multiple studies over looking at the history of life on Earth over the last 3 billion years, the plankton are both able to affect climate and are also affected by climate change. So there's intimate links between these organisms and the climate system, which we need to understand in more detail. So we wanted to focus on these organisms. We wanted to do this at the global scale, You'll see why that's important later on. It's important to do this at the global scale because the ocean is one, and everything is connected. So an organism can be in the Indian Ocean one day and can find itself in the Atlantic Ocean another day, which is not at all the case in terrestrial ecosystems where organisms are very much fixed to where they're born. Okay. So it was important to do this at the global scale. We performed two expeditions from 2009 to 2013. One of them a circumglobal expedition through the Mediterranean, the Red Sea, the Indian Ocean, across the South Atlantic, into the Southern Ocean, out into the South Pacific, the North Pacific, back to San Diego, through the Panama Canal, up to New York, and back to France. And then in 2013, we performed a separate expedition going around the Arctic Circle, passing through the Northeast Passage here and going around through the Northwest Passage up here in the same season. So throughout this this very wet part of Tara Oceans, it may look exciting when you look at it from here, but in fact we always did the same thing. Day in, day out. It was very sort of monotonous, collecting samples at each of these different sampling points. And at the end of the day, or at the end of 4 years, we had sampled at 210 sampling stations around the world, and we had brought back around 40,000 samples for subsequent biological analysis in the lab, together with other parameters which we also collected. Using a range of sampling protocols, we collected organisms from the surface down to 1,000 meters depth, and we collected everything from viruses, the very smallest organisms in the system, all the way up to the largest plankton, the metazoans. Okay. So now comes the hard part, to actually analyze those samples, which we started to do through a large international consortium. We're very happy that we could publish the first foundational results of the project in a special issue of Science on May 22nd, 2015. And in this issue, we presented five foundational papers from the project. And what is sort of the core of those papers is sort of summarized here in a nutshell. In one paper, we described a collection of, we essentially described the ocean microbiome, consisting of about 35,000 prokaryotic taxa, containing around 40 million genes. So that's about four times the number in the gut microbiome, for anyone interested in that. So unlike in the gut microbiome, the majority of these genes are new and have unknown functions. So there's really a lot of work to do to understand what those genes are doing. In terms of the viruses, in another paper we described about 5,500 different types of viruses, adding to the 39 that were previously known. Okay, so again you see the enormous discovery rate from the project. And in terms of the micro eukaryotes, the unicellular eukaryotes or protists, we described about 130,000 genetic types, which is more than 10 times the number of formally described species of marine eukaryotic plankton. Okay, and around a third of these cannot be assigned to any known taxonomic group. We have no clue what these organisms actually are. So that was sort of the start of the of description of some of the findings from the project. We subsequently generated other resources from the project, which were published later on. In this paper, we reported a global ocean atlas of eukaryotic genes. So to add to the 40 million prokaryotic genes, we now have 116 million eukaryotic genes, which represents the largest catalogue of genes from any single biome on Earth. All right. In another paper, we described single-cell genomes from abundant yet uncultured micro-eukaryotes, so organisms that we cannot culture, that we have absolutely no clue about. We now have whole genome sequences from them. And in another paper, we reported images of plankton, including from confocal microscopy, to the order of about 2.5 million images of plankton, which are freely available to anybody who's interested to look at them. And then more recently, we published another paper describing going back to the viruses again. So now we go from 5,500 types of viruses up to 200,000 types of viruses, going from pole to pole in the global ocean. And this finally begins to be close to saturation. Okay, so 200,000 viruses in the ocean appears to be sort of a conservative limit for the total number of viruses that are present in the ocean. So this is all resources, okay? It's all publicly available. People are using it, which is great to see. We need to go beyond the resources, the description of the ecosystem, to try and understand something about it. And what I'm going to talk about really is really thanks to the fact that during this whole project, we were performing uniform sampling protocols. We were looking at all kingdoms of life, including viruses. We did it at a global scale. We contextualized the data as much as we could through bringing in environmental information. And thanks to the efforts of Genoscope in Evry, we performed extremely deep DNA sequencing of the sample. So we're not only studying the most abundant organisms, the most abundant genes, but we can really dig down into the rare biosphere as well. So from that, I'm going to tell you sort of three stories of what we can do in terms of discovery from this highly contextualized data set that we have. The first aspect I'm going to deal with is going to deal with macroecological patterns, in particular latitudinal gradients of diversity in the ocean. The second aspect will be organization of ecosystem in a highly mobile, unstable environment. How on earth can ecosystems organize in such an unstable environment? And then the third aspect, I'll briefly touch on some emergent properties from complex ecological systems that we're beginning to work out from the data set. So first of all, let's look at macroecological patterns and ask the question whether plankton communities are geographically structured, and if so, why is that the case? So this really leads from work that has been done over more than 200 years now, actually, in terms of biodiversity patterns, which we know quite a lot about on land and terrestrial systems. These were first observed by Alexander von Humboldt more than a couple of hundred years ago, and he sort of noted that the nearer we approach the tropics, the greater the increase in the variety of structure, grace of form, mixture of colors, as also in perpetual youth and vigor of organic life. Wonderful quote there. And so he noticed that biodiversity is higher in the tropics. He also noted, as he was climbing different mountains, different volcanoes, including Chimborazo in Ecuador, that as you go up the mountain, that also the biodiversity changes. It's rich at the bottom and it gets poorer and poorer as you go up. And he noted that this also changed with respect to latitude in different mountains that he clambered up during his adventures. So this has led us to this general concept that there is a latitudinal gradient of species biodiversity. The more you go up in absolute latitude, the lower species richness becomes in an ecosystem. This has been observed in terrestrial ecosystems in terms of, I'm not sure what these are, I think that's birds, the biodiversity richness at the equator. This is mammals, this maybe is reptiles and amphibia. And so we see these general patterns of really being a ubiquitous feature of terrestrial environments, that species diversity increases from the poles to the equator, and it's maximal in the tropics. So what about the ocean? There's been some studies done until now, but the data to date is fragmentary. It's pulled from multiple sources. And so, in fact, we don't really know if life in a highly connected global scale ecosystem is organized differently than it is in terrestrial environments. We don't have the rules, basically. Furthermore, trans-kingdom studies have never been performed, So we thought that this could be a good opportunity, using our highly contextualized global data set, to go and look at latitudinal diversity gradients in the ocean to see how they look today and eventually project to how they may change in a future ocean impacted by climate change. So here are the basic data that we have here for the global ocean, sorted out by latitude going from the Arctic through the equator down to the Antarctic. I've separated this out by viruses, by prokaryotes, and by eukaryotes. And you see, in general, yes, we have these patterns of biodiversity being richest in the equatorial regions. I should say this is all molecular data coming from different molecular probes from these different organisms. And so, in general, yes, we do see these latitudinal gradients in the ocean. However, we do not observe it for bacteriophages. These two different classes of bacteriophages, protoviruses and myoviruses, do not display a latitudinal gradient, whereas the giant viruses, the viruses which tend to infect eukaryotes, do display quite a nice gradient. Okay, so there's an interesting pattern there. We see that these patterns generally reflect sort of temperature, sea surface temperature being highest in the equatorial regions. Okay, but things get a bit more complicated when we not only look at temperature, which is shown here, sea surface temperature, when we look at productivity of the system in terms of chlorophyll content at different latitudinal regions, which is shown here in green. And this is intra-annual variability of sea surface temperature, basically showing seasonality, then we see that we can equate these patterns with the different specific features within these different latitudinal gradients, be it for photosynthetic protists, be it for metazoans, or be it for bacteria, photosynthetic or heterotrophic bacteria. So essentially, we do see LDGs, latitudinal diversity gradients, for all organisms, except for bacteriophages, which is curious. And we see that these different LDGs do display different patterns with respect to the environmental parameters that we see here. Okay. So this is only molecular data. You may argue that this is molecular. It doesn't mean anything in terms of real biodiversity. But the nice thing about Tara Ocean's data is we have these millions of images of what the organisms actually look like. So we can take these microscopic images of the organisms, we can classify them using machine learning techniques, and we can compare the diversity within those organisms morphologically at different regions around the planet. Okay, and here we see a global T-SNE analysis of that, where we're looking at different kinds of zooplankton, metazoans, copepods, for example, salps, jellyfish, these sorts of things. And we can see that as we use these imaging data sets, that we again see latitudinal diversity gradients quite nicely in each of the different imaging data sets that we have. So that's nice to see, and when we compare the imaging data to the molecular data, you can see in general all these different tests here, we have pretty good correlations between the two. So the summary of this then is that yes, we do have latitudinal gradients in all organisms in the ocean, except for the bacteriophages. But this is only the surface ocean, all right? Now, what about at depth? Do you think there's a latitudinal gradient down in the bottom of the ocean? Interesting question, never really been addressed before. And the answer is no. There is no latitudinal gradient that we can detect within our data or data from other people, other studies, down to 3,000 meters depth. You see the diversity indices are pretty flat. No matter where you look in the global ocean. So there is no latitudinal gradient in the deep ocean as far as we can discern, which is also quite curious. So we have this data set from individual sampling points around the ocean. We can now expand that out to the entire global ocean even though we didn't sample around Japan, Australia, and so on. We can do that using generalized additive models to do that. And we can get decent data for six of the plankton functional groups that we were looking at with good statistical support, including copepods, including photosynthetic protists, photosynthetic bacteria, and so on. And you see generally, although there's quite a lot of complexity in here, we see generally that biodiversity is highest in the lower latitudes and declines as you go to the pole. So that's fine. So that is the view of today's ocean at the beginning of the 21st century, at least in the Tara Ocean. We can now take this data and project it into the future and take the data from the IPCC, in particular the CMIP-5 climate models, which are a combination of 13 different climate models from the IPCC, and we can see how those biodiversity patterns could may change, would be projected to change, as a consequence of projected changes in sea surface temperature in the year 2100, so 100 years or so from now. These are the projected changes that we have in the ocean in terms of sea surface temperature and in terms of photosynthesis, primary productivity changes in the ocean. So we can take this data and we can compare it with our biodiversity data, and we can see how biodiversity is predicted, projected to change by the end of the 21st century. So here what we're plotting here are anomalies in biodiversity, all right? So red means increases, projected increases in biodiversity, whereas the blue colors mean projected decreases in biodiversity. We've plotted this out by latitudes for the different organismal groups. And you see, in general, we project that there will be increases in biodiversity, in particular towards the Arctic, as you see here. So this means that increased biodiversity is not necessarily a good thing, okay? It's an interesting question, an interesting topic to explore later eventually. So we predict these changes in biodiversity at a global scale. The interesting thing to point out here is how these biodiversity patterns compare with fish catch in the ocean, in today's ocean, with the density of marine protected areas by latitude in the global ocean, and by carbon export in the ocean, which is basically removing carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and taking it into the ocean. So you see a lot of these projected biodiversity changes are projected to impact carbon export, projected to impact fish catch, and projected to have impacts on the efficiency of marine protected areas because of where those latitudes, where those sites are. Okay, so basically then from this study we can see that we can recover latitudinal diversity gradients for all types of plankton, but not in the deep ocean and not for bacteriophages. We can also recover these gradients at the gene level in terms of gene function. I didn't talk about that, but we can recover them for genes as well as organisms. And we can see that the changes in plankton diversity patterns can be predicted in a future ocean impacted by climate and environmental changes, although the consequences of this are uncertain in terms of fisheries, in terms of biogeochemical functions in the ocean. So that's the first topic that I wanted to address. I wanted to put this then in the context of how those latitudinal gradients are generated and maintained in a highly dynamic physical environment, right? Things are moving around all the time in the ocean. So how is it possible that these patterns are conserved in this highly mobile environment? What we have done to address that is simply look at genetic diversity station by station and compare the genetic diversity in a two-way matrix at every sampling site versus every other sampling site, and to sort of plot the genetic diversity as a function of organism size here in these two different parts of the plot. And also as a function of distance that would be estimated to travel between one sampling site and another sampling site, okay? So here we've plotted the estimated travel times. If you're a plankton hanging out here, we can see how long it would take you to travel elsewhere at all of the different sampling sites. And then we can compare the genetic distance between these sampling sites with the actual travel time that it would take to get you from, to get a plankton from A to B. This is a summary of the connectivity that we observe of plankton communities at global scale. And we see that the ocean is not at all homogeneous, but there are sort of highways of travel. The Gulf Stream is one example. So if you're in the Gulf Stream, you travel a lot faster than you are if you are down in the South Atlantic Gyre, for example, all right? And then we can take this travel time data and the genetic distance data, and we can try to look for correlations. And the interesting thing that we see is that the genomic similarity in our plankton communities essentially decays linearly up to about 1.5 years of travel time. Okay, we get a good correlation here, up to 1.5 years. So that's clear, that's fine. But then once you go beyond 1.5 years, which is also shown here, once you go beyond 1.5 years of travel time, then the genomic similarity has nothing to do with travel time, okay? So the genetic diversity in the community is determined by factors beyond simple travel time of how long it takes to get from A to B to C and so on. So we have this universal feature. It's present in the global ocean, where the ocean has a memory of 1.5 years. Okay, essentially this is what we're seeing from this data. We have no idea what that means, but it seems to be a universal feature of the ocean that the genetic memory of the system is maintained up to 1.5 years, after which it is lost. And then finally, I just want to tell you one story about emergent properties that we can see by study of these complex ecological systems beyond this 1.5 year travel time that I've just talked about previously. And I just want to say a word about the rare biosphere of organisms. So which we're able to study thanks to the very deep sequencing that was performed by Genoscope. So the rare biosphere is a common feature in all ecosystems. In all ecosystems, you have the abundant organisms that dominate the ecosystem, and then you have a very, very long tail of rare organisms, which has been observed in all ecosystems that we've looked at so far. So we don't know how much these organisms represent organisms that are on their way to extinction, or how much these organisms are sort of represent a gene pool from which the environment can select a particular taxa that could then eventually go on to dominate the ecosystem in future years. We really don't know much about this, the relation between the rare and the abundant organisms. So what we did in this Nature Ecology Evolution study that came out last year, that was led by Silvia De Monte at EBENS, was we basically looked at this rare biosphere, these rare organisms, in terms of doing rank abundance curves, going from the most abundant organisms in the ecosystem down to the rare organisms. And by looking at the frequency of abundance of those rare organisms, which are shown in the tail here, we essentially see that the frequency is always the same, okay? So no matter where you are in the global ocean, this curve, this decay of abundance in the rare biosphere is always the same. It respects a power law, so two exponents, it reflects a flat power law, and this exponent, this power law has an exponent of minus 1.3. I should say that's minus 1.3. And that's pretty much the same wherever you are in the ocean. Okay, so the rare biosphere appears to have a similar structure no matter where you are in the global ocean. So again, we see a law emerging from the data although we have no explanation for it so far. So with these three examples, I hope you've been able to see sort of different possibilities, different opportunities for discovery that are emerging from Tara Ocean's data. And in general, I think there are many other possibilities for discovery going all the way from DNA level all the way up to biome level. And in general, I think, and we're seeing from publications coming out, that the Tara Ocean's data can be used to help provide a basic molecular and a basic understanding, improved understanding of molecular cellular processes in all domains of life, beyond the canonical mice and Arabidopsis and yeast and so on, can be used to help us understand ecological and evolutionary principles. That's sort of what I focused on today. And can help us understand something about the interface between these between life in the ocean and the functioning of the Earth system, in particular the climate and the feedbacks between them. So that's a summary of, I think, opportunities for discovery from this wonderful data set. And finally, let me thank the people involved in the project. It's a multi-partner team, international team, many people involved in the work. The latitudinal gradient work was led by Lucy Zinger in my lab. The circulation patterns was led by Coloman de Vargas in Roscoff and Olivier Jaillon in Genoscope. And the final part of the talk was led by Sylvia De Monte, also in EBEN. So thank you to them and thank you to you for your attention.
Thank you, Chris. Tara is always inspiring. And thank you for taking us through those three stories that I think really capture the different dimensions. So maybe I can ask a quick question, which is, latitudinal gradient hypothesis or evidence that you have. I was just wondering how that fits with the recent paper that came out on the 200,000 viruses, where actually it seems that there is a hot spot or a hotbed, if you like, in the North Pole of viruses. So is it the case then that there are going to be these hot spots around the oceans that maybe you don't of any kind of life, not just viruses, but the plankton, but that you just didn't necessarily pick up and that you're missing out on some of these? There could be the general trend, but then there could actually be these hot spots that are due to specific things like, I mean, for plankton, I imagine, you know, things like volcanic eruptions, etc.
That is a very good question. There are indeed hot spots of biodiversity in particular regions of the planet. The Amazon, for example, the coral reef triangle in the Pacific. Eric, maybe we'll talk about it later. In spite of those hotspots, we do generally see these gradients, these large macro gradients of diversity. All right. So they do go beyond the presence of these hotspots. In terms of the viruses in the Arctic, which emerged from the recent publication, that paper sort of indicated that the Arctic was perhaps divided in two, that you have a poorer region of diversity on the eastern side and a richer region of diversity on the western side, perhaps driven by nutrients. But it's curious that, you know, you would think that if the... you would think that a virus, viral diversity, would reflect the diversity of the organisms that they can infect, in a general term, right, in general sense. But that does not appear to be the case. So, it's curious to ponder on that issue.